So in the last talk, which again seems like a very long time ago, very distant, in the last talk we heard about the Buddha's marks and how we should properly see the Buddha. We see the Buddha not through marks, but through his no possession of no marks. And this way of speaking points toward a Buddha undefined, unbounded by time and space, what is designated usually in Buddhist tradition as the Dharmakaya, the body of reality, which of course is just another mark, just another name, another label. Now that theme continues in chapter 6, although it's not immediately obvious. What we're presented with first of all is concerns about the ravages of time, about the decline of the Dharma. Subhuti is concerned about this. He's obviously impressed, moved by what the Buddha has said so far. Moved, impressed about bodhisattvas, how they stand, how they progress, how they work on their minds, how they take the bodhicitta, how they give rise to the bodhicitta, how they take the great vow, how they practice generosity, and how they regard the Buddha. But being someone concerned about the Dharma and about its future, and concerned about the welfare of others in the future, he asks, will there be any beings in the future period, in the last time, in the last epoch, in the last 500 years, at the time of the collapse of the good doctrine, the good Dharma, who, when these words of the sutra are being taught, will understand their truth? Like other things, many things in this sutra, this can sound a bit of a strange question. So we need to understand where Subhuti is coming from, as it were, or where the text is coming from. It seems from the evidence of a number of Mahayana sutras that there was this view around, probably quite widely held in the Buddhist community in India, that the Dharma was in decline, that it would decline, that you had the sort of golden age of the Buddha and his immediate disciples, and then there would be this inexorable decline over the centuries. And there's various theories put forward on the time span. Scholars have written books on this topic. There's one in our library called Once Upon a Future Time, which is all about this whole topic. Whatever, the idea is that things get steadily worse for spiritual practice, for gaining understanding and insight. Of course, there's an aspect to this which just goes with the general Buddhist realization of impermanence. Things arise and pass away. And there is, it's quite right view, that the Buddha's, Shakyamuni's teaching will completely disappear. It won't even be a memory in men's minds. When that happens, long after then, the Buddha Maitreya will appear. It hasn't come yet. The Buddha Shakyamuni's teaching is still very much alive. But there seems to be another view, and this isn't really this general Buddhist idea of impermanence. It seems to be something else going on, that things are just going to get worse for spiritual practice, for gaining understanding and insight. There's this kind of inevitability about it. Tibetan Buddhism, it seems, took over probably from very late Indian Buddhism, Hindu notions of the yugas. There's this idea in Hinduism of a sort of general sort of decline from a golden age of truth and so on. We're now living in the Kali Yuga, the black time, where things are just really, really bad. Tibetan Buddhism definitely takes this view, and it always has done that. Bad times have been around for a long time. But they don't give up. They say, well, this just means that great beings like Padmasambhava shine all the more brightly when things are particularly difficult. In Japan, you get the notion of Mappo. Things are really bad, and that was probably a lot to do with the sort of social climate in Japan, earthquakes and general social unrest, and that things are so bad that you can't really do it yourself at all. All you can do is rely on the Buddha or the White Lotus Sutra There's a whole theory there in Japanese Buddhism of Mappo. Might seem very strange to us, these ideas, and maybe even a bit un-Buddhistic, a bit fatalistic. But perhaps it's not so strange. Human nature seems to be a very nostalgic nature. As human beings, we do go in for nostalgia. We look back to some golden past when things were good, everything was right with the world. And the former Prime Minister John Major, at one time, when he was in power, gave a speech where he kind of evoked this kind of the good old days of England, warm beer, the thud of the cricket ball, the thud of leather on willow on village greens, and spinsters cycling to church, kind of evoked this kind of golden age of Britain, where, you know, with these wonderful kind of amateurs who, you know, just lived well, and everybody was kind and good to one another, and policemen, you know, were on the corner, and you know, that you could, everybody was incredibly helpful. He actually did this, extraordinary, in a multicultural society. Extraordinary, isn't it? Think of it. You even sort of get it in the FWBO. You know, the good old early days of the FWBO, where there was Banty with, you know, his robes and long hair and rings on his fingers, and, you know, the picture that sometimes evoked, well, everything was really alive, you know, and creative, and, you know, anything could happen, and, you know, and all the rest of it. Of course, conveniently leaving out, brushing out, you know, all the kind of craziness and problems, severe problems and stupidity that we engaged in. So there can be this sort of nostalgia. Maybe it's a sort of aspect of just growing old. Ancient India Buddhists, it seems, were the same. There was a view that in the time of the Buddha, everything was fine, perfect for spiritual practice. Arahants, you know, under every tree. And then there was this decline set in